This is Being Catholic with Bob Johnston on Catholic Spirit Radio 89.5.
Hi, this is Bob Johnston, and you're listening to Being Catholic right here on Catholic Spirit Radio 89.5 FM in good old McLean County, 92.5 FM in Bloomington Normal, 88.3 in Pontiac, 97.1 in Lincoln, 100 miles up and down the good old Double Nickel. And I want to remind everybody out there that we're brought to you by you. So if you're able, we would appreciate any donations that you could make. And if you would like to do that, go to our website. That's CatholicSpiritRadio.com. Again, that's CatholicSpiritRadio.com. It'll give you a lot of information about us, and it'll tell you how to make a donation. And we hope you enjoy all of our programming, and hope you enjoy the show today. I'm here with a guest today, Carl Winning. And Carl is a professor of physics over at Illinois State University. He also was a former administrator of the ISU Planetarium. Carl belongs to the Twin City Astronomy Club. And today we're going to talk about the Star of Bethlehem. Everybody likes that at Christmas time. We've had some good shows about it before. Carl's got a little bit different format this year, and we hope you'll really enjoy it. So without any further ado, I'll turn it over to Carl and let him talk a little bit maybe about himself, and he may have some other information that he wants to give our listeners out there. And after that, we'll go into the Star of Bethlehem, and we'll talk about what that really was, if we can arrive at it, and what went on back at that time. I'm sure everybody will be interested, and it'll be a great show. So, Carl, if you want to go ahead and start a little bit about yourself and maybe go into your topic.
By all means. I really want to say thank you very much for having me on the program today. This tends to be a topic which is highly interesting to many people, and I've been working in this area for actually close to 30, 35 years now, and you know, I don't work too much on it anymore, but there's still new things to be found if we keep looking more broadly in the literature. And today I'm bringing in more than just my traditional affair. I'm bringing along some citations from things like the Proto-Evangelium of James. We're going to take a look at some of the writings that are attributed to Anne Catherine Emmerich and so on, things that I've mentioned in the past. Today we'll go go into them.
I'll jump in there a little bit. It is amazing, isn't it, how a particular topic, if you go over it and come back again, a topic like this, how much more you can sometimes find out and how much more interesting it is as you go along. You never learn everything on one reading or one sitting of anything, and when you visit it again and again, it seems like you always pick up something new.
Oh, it's amazing. I'm currently revising one of my published books. It's a 3-volume book on physics teaching. And it's amazing, but after a few years, you say, "Wow, I wrote that," or "I know so much more now." It's really invigorating to kind of go back over and over and treat it in a recursive fashion. You know, that's what science does too. Sure. It just goes back and looks and looks and looks again, because there's always new things, new subtle nuances that really sometimes can have major effect.
How did you ever get interested in the Star of Bethlehem? Now, of course, you're an astronomer,
sure.
And that's the sky. Of course, is something that you're fascinated with, and I am too, not on the level, you know, of knowledge that you are, but I think most people are interested in it. And so how did you, focus in on the Star of Bethlehem itself?
Sure. Well, it's actually a combination of two things, I think. One, when I was a child, the nativity set that we had, when we were young, it was always set up early in Advent, and as time went on, we had some camels, and the camels would approach and approach and approach the creche that we had there. And it wasn't until the Epiphany that they actually arrived. And, of course, we always had there on the little creche itself a little Star of Bethlehem. And that kind of intrigued me. And, you know, what was the Star of Bethlehem? So even as a youngster, I knew that. And then probably in 1957, on the summers, my grandfather would take me out during the summer nights and show me the constellations and bright stars and planets of the sky. I still remember that. And I think it was just a natural confluence of those two things, the faith and the science, that made me start wondering about what is this thing called the Star of Bethlehem.
And that's so important, I think, saying, you know, your grandfather took you out. It is important to take kids out and show them things. I mean, it's one thing to study nature inside of a laboratory in a sterile environment. It's another thing to go out there and look up and wonder, or look down and wonder at the animals and the flora and the fauna and that kind of thing. So it's something that all of us can do. It doesn't take much. There are places to go all around Bloomington Normal. And take kids out into nature, let them see the night sky, and do things like that. It led to a wonderful, wonderful gift to you.
Absolutely.
And that lasted you the rest of your life.
Yes, and I handed it on to my kids the same way. Both of them are in science backgrounds now.
And the one thing I wanted to ask a little bit of, you know, you're an astronomer and you're a physicist, and there seems to be, at least most people, you know, see this, and maybe you should comment on it. Sometimes there seems to be a tension between science and religion, and you're interested in the Star of Bethlehem both from a scientific and a religious point of view. Can you talk about that just
sure.
a little bit, Carl?
You know, a lot of people think that there's a conflict between religion and science, and honestly, I don't believe there is. I think it's imperative to understand that both must properly be understood. John Paul II said that in his own pontificate. You know, there is no conflict. There is no conflict. I mean, you know, the concept of things like evolution versus creationism. I mean, in 1950s, Pius XII put out something called Humani Generis, and it's an encyclical about human evolution. And it says there's nothing wrong with human evolution as long as we give God his due. And I've always believed that sort of approach. So I don't see conflict. If there is conflict, it's usually on the basis of understanding. Even in physics, when we see things that seemingly are contradictory, what happens is that there's a deeper truth. If you take a look at the concept of relativity, if you say you take a ball and you're on a railroad car moving along at a constant speed, and you throw the ball up and down in the air. Now, if you're riding on the train, the ball appears to go straight up and down. But then if you have a bystander next to the rails, and the bystander looks at the ball, goes up and down, the ball moves in a parabolic arch. Well, which is it, straight up and down or parabolic arch? They're both correct. It's a matter of relativity, and that's the deeper truth.
That's very interesting. How do you go about, you know, doing, for maybe people out there that would like to do a little bit of research on their own or get interested in this subject, how do you go about doing research on the so-called star? And I'm using the word so-called there because there are people, you know, and I'm sure yourself and myself too, we don't really for sure know exactly what it is. And so, you know, how do you go about this?
Right. It turns out that the name star really comes from the use of the early languages here. They described it in the Bible as a star. I mean, we wouldn't know about the Star of Bethlehem if it wasn't for the Bible itself. And many times things in the sky were given names, stars. When we have an exploding star, it's called a nova today, but it was to them a new star. Nova literally means news. They had planetes stellaris, which were the wandering stars. They're the planets, and they, as they orbit the sun, appear to move left and right among the background of stars many times, and they can attract attention. You've got the hairy stars, the so-called cometas, the hairy stars. You know, take out your coma and coma your hair. You know, that Latin is coma, means is hair. It's a hairy star. So many things in the sky were called stars. And unless you were an astronomer, you know, you probably wouldn't have known the distinction. But even back then, they didn't know the distinction. So we use the word star very generically.
Sure. And the fact is that we also should remember that people back at that time had a very good knowledge, many of them, of the sky, because at night, shepherds and other people, you know, there was not all kinds of light like we have today.
Mm-hmm.
They could see the sky. They thought that, you know, signs of wonder and signs from God and so forth were written on the sky. So they watched it very closely,
yes,
and they were very, very, very aware, but probably far more aware of what was going on in the heavens than most of us are today.
Well, do you realize that the ancient Sumerians had the year nailed down to its correct length to within 6 seconds.
Wow, I didn't know that.
I don't think most modern space-age people would know how to do that.
It'd be very, very difficult, and they did it without all the instruments
that's
that we
right.
have at our
Not
disposal
about their
today.
Unaided eyes.
Right, exactly. But at least many of them were living in areas in which you know, it wasn't like living in Illinois.
you could see things,
Yeah, so, okay, Carl, this is sort of interesting and just the beginning, really.
Okay, well, let's take a look very quickly at the Star of Bethlehem, and we will read passages from the Bible because that really becomes the source of our knowledge of the Star of Bethlehem. But before that, let's just take a look at some of the physical phenomena that people in the past, primarily astronomers, have suggested that might have served as the Star of Bethlehem. One of them is the Aurora Borealis or the Northern Lights. I don't know how many of you have ever seen auroras. Have you seen them before?
Yes, I have. I was out one time at Evergreen Lake, and this has been a number of years ago. And I can't remember. I think it was in the fall. And it was incredible. The aurora reached all the way to here. In fact, I called up my wife from out there. I think we didn't have the kind of phones we have today. I forget how I did it, but I did. And told her to go outside and look. It was a beautiful starry night, and it was just gorgeous. I had never seen anything like that before.
The sky was a splash with colors.
It was splashed with colors. I can remember it seemed like there were lots of sort of greens.
That was over 30 years ago.
Yeah.
I remember that night quite well because I was still at that time planetarium director, and I would get telephone calls from the radio stations, and they would say, what's that out there? Is that aurora? I'd run out and take a look.
Yeah, I knew what it was. I mean, I knew it was the aurora, but, you know, it was just spectacular, and I just didn't realize you could see it that well this far south, and I have never seen a display like that.
Yeah, well, that's the important thing, though, it's to realize it's quite rare. It's so rare, in fact, that because of that observation that you had and I had those 30 years ago or so, I have missed auroras since that time, and in October of last year, I went to Iceland for a week just to watch auroras because they're so fantastic. And if you've never seen an aurora under a good dark sky, you don't understand how it could be as though it's carrying some sort of a message. And, you know, down around this latitude here, they're pretty rare, a good aurora every 10 years or so. But if you go down to the area of, say, Bethlehem, which is closer to the equator, you're going to get it less frequently. So what happens, it could be once in 100 years, which means there probably isn't much of a oral tradition about this ghostly light that appears in the sky. So it doesn't seem to be a bad idea, but it does have some problems with it. I mean, it does come and go, which is important. We're going to hear about that when we talk about the scripture itself and what it talks about the star. But, yeah, it has problems. And again, let's take a look at the other thing, hairy star. Have you ever seen a hairy star? This comets?
There's a comet. Of course, I've watched a comet Koatec, and then what was the comet, the most recent one that was over in the south?
It was Hale-Bopp, probably.
Yeah, Hale-Bopp is what I'm trying to think of. Yeah,
And there was Iris Araki, a cock that came across the northern sky a few years before that one, too.
And I found out a lesson. It was actually, I went out to Evergreen. I think the astronomy club had observations out there and observed. I observed Halley's Comet when it came again out there. And actually, though, on Hale-Bopp and some of the others, it was, as far as being pretty, it was just as pretty, maybe I think more pretty to actually look at it through your binoculars.
Yeah.
Even though you saw it, you know, more resolved in a telescope, it wasn't quite as spectacular as it was just looking at it through binoculars.
Right, because you see that long, long tail.
Yeah.
Yeah, Iris Araki Alcock, when it was up here in the northern sky, most people never saw that one because it wasn't too terribly long after things like Halley's Comet, which, you know, people got really disappointed with. And so they never went out and took a look at this next comet that came by. But it had a 35-40 degree tail. It was spectacular. And yet, you know, and anybody who's seen a comet knows that, wow, this is a real attention getter.
And it would have been, of course, back at that in, you know, ancient times.
Absolutely.
Because they watched the sky a lot. And when things like that appeared, I mean, you know, they knew that it was something different than what appeared normally in the regular sky.
But unfortunately, if you go back and take a look at the literature from around that time, many people recorded comets in the sky. Many cultures did. But interestingly, they were generally considered a portent of doom. So if you saw a comet in the sky, it was a bad, bad omen. So I don't know if people would have taken that to be an indication that there's a newborn king somewhere. A couple of weeks ago, there was a giant meteor that went across Illinois and was somewhere over St. Louis when it exploded.
Wow, I didn't know that.
Did you hear? Oh, there
no,
was.
I don't know how I missed that. I usually try to, you know, pay attention to those things.
Yeah, well, there's some really interesting footage, including members from our own astronomy club, where they had security cameras at their houses, and they actually caught the explosion. It was spectacular. I've seen many, many things of it. And some people have suggested that a bright meteor, an exploding meteor, the bolide, in fact, might have been the star of Bethlehem. But unfortunately, it doesn't seem to have all these other attributes that are necessary for the star Bethlehem that we'll talk about. It tends to be a flash in the pan sort of thing.
Right.
It's here and then it's gone. And, you know, by the time you see it and go, ooh, and then it's gone.
We saw a pretty spectacular meteor when my wife and I, about 4 or 5 years ago, I'm not sure exactly, we were coming back. I think it was we spent a Thanksgiving afternoon and evening at my daughter's. and we were coming back heading west, right here in North Normal, going to our home. And one came from the, it seemed like it was coming sort of from the south to the north. Mm-hmm. Across in front of our car. It was, bigger than you usually see. It wasn't just a little streak. It was quite a spectacular. But, of course, by the time it hit the ground, it was probably fairly small.
Yeah. If they had hit the ground at all. Yeah, because
it
usually burn up the atmosphere. I've seen them bright enough that they actually have challenged the sun's brightness during the daytime.
Yeah. This seemed like perhaps it did. I mean, sometimes I've seen them before when they get closer, it seems like the deer, they seem to actually, it's an optical illusion, but they seem to actually curve or zigzag a little bit.
Well,
those are pretty close in.
A lot of times, the impression is that they're close because they're so incredibly bright, but typically these things are 70, 80, 90, 100 miles up.
Are they?
Okay. Yeah, so they're pretty far away. Well, again, I mentioned a little while ago the word nova. Sometimes exploding stars, the firmament, we talk about the firmament, the sky. And, firm means unchanging, essentially. But the fact of the matter is the sky does change. New stars appear from time to time. I don't know how many people know about the Crab Nebula, a supernova that appeared in our sky in the year 1054 AD. And it was bright enough to be seen during the daytime for months. And, some people have suggested that that's the case. But, again, it has limitations that we'll talk about a little bit later on.
Okay.
And then we hear things like planetary conjunctions. Sometimes planets move back and forth relative to the background stars. They pass certain bright stars or move in certain constellations or maybe pass one another. Recently, I've pointed out on some Facebook pages for the Twin City Amateur Astronomers how we've had Venus and Jupiter together in the evening sky a few weeks ago, and then a couple of days after that we had Saturn and Venus. And those are a couple of conjunctions. So anybody who's seen those has a good understanding of what we're talking about, planetary passings. And so they're not terribly uncommon. And that, of course, makes it kind of problematical for them serving as a star of Bethlehem, because conjunctions like that are really quite spectacular. It wasn't but a few years ago we actually had a triple passing of Jupiter and Saturn in our night sky. And, occurred over a period of several months, but some people suggested that was a star of Bethlehem, but let's admit it's not unique. It happens from time to time. And there will be a beautiful series of near conjunctions in 2020 with Jupiter and Saturn. And, it's happening again, second time in my lifetime. Not a big deal.
Much of the stargazers, mostly are probably of the stargazers back at that time, probably then if these things reoccur fairly often, would have been aware.
Yeah.
They maybe not have known what they were, but they would have been aware that these come and go, and they probably wouldn't have been looking at them as something really, really unique.
Yeah, if the Magi were indeed astronomers, and I suspect they may well have been, then we need to take a look at things from their perspective, not from our perspective. We might be amazed by a meteor or even a comet, but an astronomer generally wouldn't be. So, if I saw those things in the sky, being with the background I've got, would I start a journey? Probably not, because I can recognize the day-to-day sort of things. Well, I'll tell you what. Maybe this would be a good time, before we run out of time, just to read one biblical passage.
Okay. We've got a little bit of time here before we take a break, so if you can read that, and then we'll come right back to it.
Very good. So let's go ahead and take a look at the story of the star as expressed in Matthew chapter 2. It starts, "After Jesus was born in Bethlehem in Judea, during the time of King Herod, Magi from the east came to Jerusalem and asked, 'Where is the one who has been born King of the Jews? We saw his star when it rose and have come to worship him.' When King Herod heard this, he was disturbed, and all Jerusalem with him. When he had called together all the people's chief priests and teachers of the law, he asked them where the Messiah was to be born. 'In Bethlehem of Judea,' they replied, 'for this is what the prophet has written. But you, Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are by no means least among the rulers of Judah, for out of you will come a ruler who will shepherd my people Israel.'"
We're going to take a break right here. Stay with us. We're going to come right back and talk about this. So we'll be right back.
You've been listening to Being Catholic with Bob Johnston on Catholic Spirit Radio 89.5.
Join Jason Bramley of Catholic Conversations on a religious journey across Greece, following in the footsteps of the Apostle Paul. This 9-night, 10-day tour begins and ends in Athens, starting with 5 nights on land, followed by a 3-night cruise. The final night is back in Athens to bring this journey to a close. For more information on this spiritual trip, call Ben McKenna, 309-922-9222. 1758.
Hi, this is Bob Johnston. You're listening to Being Catholic. We're back from our break, and I'm here with Carl Winning, and we're talking about the Star of Bethlehem. And Carl was just talking about a quotation here from Matthew 2, and we're going to come back to that and talk a little bit more about that as we go along.
Sure. Well, we had just heard a little about the wise men coming in after seeing a star in the east. And then let me continue the saga as it appears in Matthew. Then Herod called the Magi secretly and found out from them the exact time the star had appeared. He sent them to Bethlehem and said, "Go and search carefully for the child. As soon as you find him, report to me so that I too may go and worship him." After they had heard the king, they went on their way, and the star that they had seen when it rose went ahead of them until it stopped over the place where the child was. When they saw the star, they were overjoyed. On coming to the house, they saw the child with his mother Mary, and they bowed down and worshipped him. Then they opened their treasures and presented him with gifts of gold, frankincense, and myrrh. And having been warned in a dream not to go back to Herod, they returned to their country by another route.
So, Carl, as both a scientist and a Catholic Christian, what do you make of this story? You know, what is your take on it? What is, your first reaction as a scientific researcher?
Well, my first reaction is that this is curious, okay? Some sort of a divine portent in the heavens, perhaps. It seems to have certain types of traits that, at least to me, don't sound anything astronomical per se. The word star is used, and there are interesting terminology which is associated with the sky and motions of objects in the sky. It just doesn't seem to me to be any of the things on the aforementioned list. I mean, I'm taking this from a Catholic Christian perspective with science background. And like I said, I don't see any sort of conflict between the two as long as they're properly understood. So I think that, you know, if one has an open mind and is willing to consider supernatural explanations, or even, you know, non-supernatural, others, you know, the non-physical explanations, then one must at least take a look at them to have a viewpoint that it can only be a particular physical phenomenon which is readily explained is a false assumption. It's what we call scientism, and it's not science. Scientism says essentially that science has answers to all questions. Let me tell you, it does not. And to believe that it does is a major fallacy. So, again, I try to remain open-minded. I do separate the science from the religious belief. But, again, I don't see them as being, you know, conflicting necessarily. So we'll take a look at some of these other explanations. Again, not always physical and not always, you know, theological.
Okay, that sounds like it'd be very interesting. Let's go on.
Okay, so when you start your study of the Star of Bethlehem, you know, because the passage of Matthew is one of the areas where we've got some good information about what it was, then you have to say, what is the passage actually telling us? I mean, there's multiple interpretations and multiple versions, but they basically will tell us the same thing if you study the original languages in which the book was written. So let's go ahead. First off, there's this phrase that says, when we saw the star. Literally, there's an appendage which means at its rising. It wasn't in this particular passage that we read in terms of its translation, but we saw a star at its rising. What does that mean? Well, it means that they saw it in the east because stars rise in the eastern sky. So we saw it at its rising. So, okay, it's maybe in the eastern sky. Obviously, it had some sort of a clear message. It was enough to encourage the trip of the Magi. Remember, these people weren't fools. If they were, in fact, well-informed, educated astronomers, astrologers of their day, then they would be familiar with the things of the sky. They'd be familiar with things like, you know, maybe the comets and the shooting stars and planetary configurations and motions across the sky. They wouldn't have been surprised by that. This thing, whatever they saw, had to have a very clear and definitive meaning. Or why would they undertake a journey that could take weeks, months, and put them in potentially high danger? Traveling in the Middle East at that time by a caravan, if that's what they did, was relatively safe, but not absolutely so. We hear that the star had a leading action. Okay, had a leading action. I mean, it actually led them to the very house where the child was. Now, remember, it's using the word house, which is a legitimate use of the word because, you know, we hear that Jesus was perhaps born in a cave. And now we're talking a house. So this was several weeks, days, months, we don't know, after the Christ child was born. And actually, it could have been as much as 2 years when you know about this story of Herod slaughtering the holy innocents of Bethlehem. That occurred 2 years, perhaps as much as 2 years after the birth of Christ. Because remember, Herod had all young males, 2 years of age and younger, slaughtered.
You're right. And, you know, of course, when stories are told, often they're compressed. And mm-hmm. so we get sometimes the impression that everything happened sort of at once, right. like in one or two nights. But of course,
right.
if they were traveling, especially, you know, in those days by caravan and so forth, you didn't, you know, you weren't traveling very fast. So
no,
if you were traveling any distance, it took a while.
And it'd be expensive, too. So you had to be really convinced of some sort of a message, and you had to have a clear leading action. But what's interesting is that they talk about the star disappearing upon the Magi's arrival in Jerusalem. You know, where is this king? You know, and then suddenly when they leave the Herod's court, oh, there it is. It reappears and leads them to the very house. That's amazing. And, you know, maybe it was visible only to the Magi. I mean, you know, the Jews looked into the sky. I mean, who doesn't look into the sky? And this star thing evidently was not visible to Herod. It was not visible to the chief priests. It was not visible to the scribes. Something was special was happening. So maybe it wasn't an object that was far, far up in the sky. Maybe it was something closer to the earth.
So from the scientific perspective then, what are the natural explanations that have been offered, you know, for this particular event?
Yeah, well, like I say, it's things like novas and comets and aurora borealis and meteors, exploding stars, whatever.
Doesn't seem like they fit.
They don't fit. That's the point. And if you've got an open mind, you'll say, okay, then what else might it have been? I mean, could a planetary conjunction explain this sort of stuff? Well, if you understand the motion of the planets and stars well enough to understand a message from them, then you're going to understand how these things move. And you're not going to be surprised. You're not going to walk into Jerusalem and say, hey, where'd the star go? It's gone. Conjunctions just don't disappear and then suddenly reappear and then lead to the very house where the Christ child is.
Yeah, that seems, hard to explain.
It is.
It appears and then it disappears. I mean, something in the sky, I can imagine it disappearing here in Illinois with the cloudy skies. But if these people were traveling over a long time in that area of the world, it wouldn't seem like, you know, when they say it disappeared, it wouldn't seem like just it was momentarily blocked by clouds or something like
that. Yeah. So let's talk about these objects very briefly, just to give you some sense about them. You know, what is aurora borealis? It's something that, you know, we've seen, we know it's impressive, but is it spiritual? No, it's not. I mean, if you go to the Norse countries, you know, I've been up in Norway and I've been up in Iceland, and I've listened to the local stories of creatures living in the sky, looking down on us and stuff like that. But no, it's not. What it is nothing more than charged particles coming in from the sun. And, you know, there's these titanic explosions occur on the sun from time to time, large coronal mass eruptions, we call them. And these charged particles moving at 1 to 2 million miles per hour pass out through those solar system, and they collide with the Earth's magnetic field, where these charged particles are then channeled down into the Earth's atmosphere, and they strike the nitrogen, the oxygen, and stuff like that in the atmosphere, and they force it to glow because they're carrying a tremendous amount of energy with these high speeds of motion. So, you know, they're readily explainable. Back then, they weren't, and we didn't understand them until a little over 100 years ago, but we do now, and they're no, you know, they're just a natural phenomenon.
What about a comet?
Comets are same way, natural.
I mean, they do move. I mean,
oh, they do.
So they would move from one place to another in the sky.
Right, but if when you were looking at, say, Hale Bopp back in the 80s, you know, it could have stood over any house. I mean, imagine it sitting in the southern sky. It's tens of millions, maybe hundreds of million miles away. And it, depending on where you walk, it'll stand over every house in town.
You're right.
So it really doesn't have the leading action. And I haven't seen too many comets disappear in a way that they, like, whoa, it came back. You know, it doesn't do that.
Yeah.
These people knew that these things moved around the sky. So, again, these are nothing more than hairy stars, as we call them. But we know them today to be dirty snowballs. They're just giant chunks of ice. Actually, a lot of water ice, methane, ammonia tied into them, lots of dust, like dirty sandbanks flowing through the sky. But again, they can be very, very brilliant, very, very bright. But they really just simply don't have that kind of leading action that I'm thinking that they would need to do. And then again, the comet is a portent of doom. It's not something you would consider be there to announce the birth of a savior.
Okay, so then if we eliminate those, then what do we go on to?
Well, there are several suggestions we had mentioned before, too. Meteors. I mean, meteors are pretty common, and they really are attention-getting. But, man, they don't have much of a leading action. I mean, they shoot across the sky. If you take a look at a picture of them, they say, oh, there it is. But let's remember, they're here and they're gone in a flash. And meteors, if you're like me, I'm outside, you know, a lot of clear nights. And I look up, boom, every once in a while I'll see a meteor. Sometimes I've seen the exploding meteors. Like I mentioned earlier, I've seen meteors as bright as the sun, even during the daytime. So they're not that uncommon, especially if you spend a lot of time outside. So no leading action, a flash in the pan sort of thing, no meshes, just like, wow, boom, it's over.
Yeah, they would have saw a lot of them if they were watching the night sky there in a desert like that, in that area of the world. I shouldn't say just desert, but nevertheless, they would have probably been very familiar with meteors.
They would. And, you know, nighttime sky was entertainment for a lot of people. They sat out and told stories under the stars and watched around the campfires, and they looked up at night and saw the stars. They were there all the time. The skies were dark. You know, you could see the stars here in the cities of America and around the world. There's so much light pollution that you can't see them at night, so we've forgotten the glory of the heavens. Do you realize that perhaps as much as 25-30% of the American population has never seen the Milky Way?
That's true.
That's shocking. That's shocking.
I remember being able to look up and see it when I was a kid, you know, in our little hometown. We didn't have a lot of lights, the street lights, and it seemed like a lot of the streets had those little covers over them, so they sort of shone down. And you could look up in a lot of places at the night sky and see the Milky Way very clear, especially in the wintertime, it seemed like.
Yeah. And these things like exploding stars, the novas, or even the supernovas are pretty spectacular. I have seen supernovas through my telescope, but in my lifetime, I've not seen one. There was one visible in the southern hemisphere, visible in the Large Magellanic Cloud a few years ago, an exploding star, but they're pretty uncommon. And again, they don't have much leading action. They just stay in the same place among the background of stars. So, again, not much there by way of explanation. So, you know, another things that have been suggested that perhaps there are planetary conjunctions. And, again, come up this next year, you're going to have a chance to see some beautiful motions of Jupiter, Saturn, and Mars across the sky. I encourage anybody who's interested in that, pay attention to the Twin City Amateur Astronomers Facebook page. We describe on a daily basis almost what's going on in the sky, if there's something interesting to show. But, you know, sometimes these ideas of planetary conjunctions, the passages of two planets, or maybe the passage of a star past a planet past a prominent star, like among the stars of Leo the Lion, the King, you know, some say astrologically that's interpreted as the indicator, as that this is the star of Bethlehem. No, it's not really a star. It was simply a passage of a planet or two past a star or another planet. And, you know, not a big deal because, first off, let's remember that a lot of people didn't believe in astrology. Those who did, well, that's fine. But there's really no empirical basis for making these claims that people have. I mean, if you say that, you know, Jupiter, the king planet, goes past Regulus, the king star, that there's a savior born in the land of Israel, okay. Or maybe if you get a triple conjunction of Jupiter and Saturn that occurs in the Pisces, the fishes, that this is the land of the Jews. I mean, come on, guys. Where do you get this stuff? There's no empirical basis for it at all.
Do you think there's an effort made sometime by people, you know, seculars, who strongly want some kind of ordinary explanation to sort of like demythologize the biblical explanations, and so they push explanations a little bit harder than they should?
I suspect that that's generally true. Not always, but I suspect generally it is. Some people just perhaps feel a little bit afraid to suggest non-physical interpretations. They say it's outside of my realm as an astronomer. And to some extent, it's true. But I will admit that I'm a Catholic Christian astronomer, and there's a difference perhaps. You know, I don't see science as the ultimate end-all, be-all.
So how do you evaluate, then, these, Carl, according to, you know, in the light of biblical evidence?
Well, I think it's a matter of simply looking at the evidence and asking yourself what fits. So that's what I want to do. I want to take a look at, you know, again, we've talked about the natural phenomenon and how they really seem not to satisfy the criteria which we outlined a little bit earlier. So I'm going to suggest that perhaps the star was not a physical phenomenon at all. Some people say, well, what do you mean by that? Well, maybe it was some sort of a theophany. A theophany is nothing more than a presence of God, a manifestation of the presence of God. It's a possibility. Some people suggest it might be what's called Midrash, M-I-D-R-A-S-H, and that's kind of like a parable and more in the Jewish tradition. But, you know, Jesus used parables all the time. You know, there's the story of the prodigal son. Remember that. Jesus is trying to make the point with the story. The question is this what happened in Matthew? Is he simply trying to make a point? Do we treat the story as apocryphal? You know, those are theological type questions that we have to address for sure. So let's go ahead and ask the question about non-physical phenomena. And what I want to do is bring in to the discussion the story of the star as it relates to the shepherds, because we know that the shepherds came and praised Christ at the time of his birth. We find that in Luke chapter 2. So let me go ahead and read from that particular chapter and see what this says. And there were shepherds living out in the field nearby, keeping watch over their flocks at night. An angel of the Lord appeared to them, and the glory of the Lord shone around them, and they were terrified. But the angel said to them, "Do not be afraid. I bring you good news that will cause great joy for all the people. Today in the town of a Savior has been born to you. He is the Messiah, the Lord. This will be a sign to you. You will find a baby wrapped in clothes and lying in a manger." Suddenly a great company of the heavenly hosts appeared with the angel praising God, saying, "Glory to God in the highest, and on earth peace to those on whom his favor rests."
And with that wonderful and very, very colorful description, we're going to take a break here and stop, and we'll come right back, so stay with us.
You've been listening to Being Catholic with Bob Johnston on Catholic Spirit Radio 89.5.
Did you know that you can donate to Catholic Spirit Radio through your IRA? If you are 70 and a half or older, you can make a charitable transfer of IRA assets, also known as a QCD, a qualified charitable distribution, which is treated as a gift to Catholic Spirit Radio and for which you will receive tax benefits in return. If you make a QCD, you receive a credit against those pesky required minimum distributions, also known as RMDs, that you otherwise have to take from your IRA annually. Your qualified charitable distribution is excluded from taxable income, which may reduce the amount of Social Security benefits which are otherwise subject to income tax. As you plan for 2020 or even 2021, we encourage you to consider making a gift of IRA assets to Catholic Spirit Radio. You'll receive these tax benefits even if you do not itemize. If you're interested in donating to Catholic Spirit Radio through your IRA, please contact your tax advisor.
Hi, this is Bob Johnston. You're listening to Being Catholic, right here on Catholic Spirit Radio. We're back from our break. I'm talking with Carl Winning, and we're talking about the Star of Bethlehem, and we were talking about the story of the shepherds, and Carl's going to continue with that a little bit more, so we'll come back to it.
Very good. So just before break, we heard about something happening in the fields at night, and the shepherds are seeing something that's making them quite afraid. We've got statements here that there's angels in the sky. Like, wow, that's pretty impressive. That doesn't sound very physical to me. So it sounds more divinely related. So let's continue that passage. When the angels had left them, that is the shepherds, and gone into heaven, the shepherds said to one another, "Let's go to Bethlehem and see this thing that has happened, which the Lord has told us about." So they hurried off and found Mary and Joseph and the baby who was lying in the manger. When they had seen him, they spread the word concerning what had been told them about this child, and all who heard it were amazed at what the shepherds said to them. But Mary treasured up all these things and pondered them in her heart. The shepherds returned glorifying and praising God for all the things that they had heard and seen, which were just as they had been told. So, what do you think?
Well, I don't know so far. I'm still wondering here exactly, you know, the shepherds are attracted to this. We have the Magi, who are probably more knowledgeable about the skies than the shepherds were. Mm-hmm. And they're attracted to this, and yet it so far doesn't seem to be some kind of physical explanation that we can really put our fingers on.
Yeah.
So it's a mystery, and I think, you know, we should explore that.
Yeah, that is. And that's the reason I think you need to, if you're open-minded about it, you do explore it. And so, you know, this concept of the glory of the Lord is not really unique to the New Testament, because I'm willing to investigate the Bible at considerable length, and have done so over the years. I've come to the realization that this thing called the glory of the Lord is something which would have terrified the shepherds. The glory of the Lord, what does that mean? Well, if you start investigating the Old Testament, you'll hear this word glory of the Lord used quite a few times. In fact, I found over 60 citations of the glory of the Lord during Old Testament times. And the reason the shepherds were afraid, you know, so terribly afraid, is because of the fact they realized what it was.
They certainly wouldn't have been frightened at the ordinary things. They were well aware of very many natural events in the sky and in the earth around them. They were very, you know, interested in nature, interested in the sky, and so they wouldn't have been easily frightened at
that
thing.
And it's interesting to note that they weren't just simply afraid, they were terrified.
And so they're terrified here, so this is something very, very, very unusual.
It truly has
and
to be.
And also maybe something that they were aware of in a way that had been prophesied that was coming, and they weren't exactly sure how they should treat it.
Yeah, I'm afraid they recognized it for what it was. And if they were familiar with Old Testament scriptures, which I'm sure many of them were, then they were justified in being terrified. Because if you look in the Old Testament, you're going to see this thing. And it's called the glory of the Lord. Again, I'll make, for those available who want it, you know, a list of citations on the glory of the Lord.
And we have to remember also, as you know, from a scientific point of view, we start with, you know, the material world. We start with certain givens. And so we're not, you know, this idea that we have an explanation for everything. We don't have the explanation behind those givens or underneath those givens. And when you're starting there, you're starting in an entirely different realm.
Yeah, and I think that's what they realize. We're looking at a different realm here. I mean, this idea of this glowing cloud of light, you're going to see it, the glory of the Lord. You see it advertised in the advertisement, described in the Old Testament. And here's just three places where you might think of, wow, I never thought about this. But the glory of the Lord was present for Moses at the time of the burning bush. Remember, Moses comes up and says, what is this? And the Lord says to him, from the fire of the burning bush, which was not consumed, remove your shoes, for you stand upon holy ground. And when asked, after he was given a commission to go and retrieve the people from the Hebrews out of Egypt, the land of slavery, and Moses asked, well, who should I say sent me? And the voice comes from the burning bush, I am who am. And the only I am I know of in the Bible, or in the universe, who exists necessarily and sufficiently, is God Almighty.
And just think of that answer. I mean, that answer actually goes deeper than the material world. I mean, it goes beneath it. I am that I am, or I am who I am.
Yep.
I mean, you know, it's not like I was, or I will be, or I am right now. It's just I exist.
Yes.
The existence itself.
Who has sent me? I am has sent me. That's amazing. And then again, take a look at the idea of the pillar of fire and the smoke that led the Israelites in the Exodus after, you know, they moved out of Egypt. There's constantly a fire burning at night and a pillar of cloud by day. And Moses goes into the tent of the dwelling and sees the fire and comes out with his face glowing. No man shall see the face of God and live, it said. And so now we're seeing this physical manifestation of a glowing fire that appears to be, you know, the presence of God, a manifestation of his presence. And then again, we also see the sort of thing, if you take a look at Mount Sinai during the time the Ten Commandments were handed down, what was he moved into? He went into a cloud of fire and lightning and all this other brilliant light at the top of Mount Sinai. From there he descended, having spoken with God, picking up the Ten Commandments on the way. So pretty amazing sort of stuff here. So again, as I say, over 60 Old Testament citations of the glory of the Lord, and unless you actually take a look at some of those, you don't really understand what we're talking about. And so, I mean, I can give you a list. In fact, before it's all over, I'll make available to the station here a Bible study where people can go back and take a look at these, and they're going to come away as awestruck as I have been. But, you know, look in Genesis and Exodus and Numbers and Deuteronomy, 1 Kings, also called 1 Samuel, 2 Chronicles, Isaiah, Ezekiel, Habakkuk. These are all areas where you see one or even many citations of the glory of the Lord. And again, it's always this cloud of light.
OK, Can we look at these citations in more detail? And, you know, are there any New Testament theophanies that would shed light on this?
Indeed, there truly are. To think that it's restricted only to the Old Testament would be, you know, quite unfortunate, because you do see it. So first off, the shepherds at the birth of Christ. Then let's not forget that over Jesus' baptism in the Jordan River with John the Baptist, there's a Lord appearing as a paraclete, as a dove over them, perhaps a cloud of light. I don't know for sure. But, you know, this is my son. The light of the transfiguration, when John and James and Peter went up the hill with Jesus, he's transfigured before them and is surrounded. They're immersed in a cloud of light. This is my begotten, holy begotten son. You know, listen to him. And the three apostles fall down in utter fear. And standing there beside Jesus is Moses and Elijah, the prophet, the light of the transfiguration. Like when you say at the end, there's a cloud. When Jesus ascends into heaven, he ascends into a cloud of light. And, you know, then there's the descent of Holy Spirit at Pentecost, 50 days after the ascension. And they come, the Holy Spirit comes to them upon them as flames. You know, the presence of that light constantly. Saul, on his way to persecute the Jews, is knocked off of his horse by a ball of light. And from that comes the voice of Jesus. Saul, Saul, why are you persecuting me? So these are just some examples of where you'll see it in the New Testament, this cloud of light.
So if these glories of the Lord were actually, you know, physically manifested, are there any secular sources that refer to these kinds of things?
Actually, there really are. And over the years, I've kind of collected a few of them here. You can go back as early as the Flavius Josephus. He wrote about the battles of the wars of the Jews. And there's an interesting passage in there when Vespasian and Titus were responsible for the sacking of Jerusalem in 70 A.D., Flavius Josephus is there. He's a Jewish general, but he's an apologist for a Jew. So he explains the history of the Jews and so on. And one of the things he records is that just before, the night before Jerusalem fell and the walls were pulled down by the Romans, there was a tremendous rushing from the Holy of Holies, so sounding like a wind coming out. And there was tremendous light there, and there was a huge roar. And there's a voice that says, "Let us go forth." And it said that from the temple, a huge ball of light ascended and went out over the eastern gate and disappeared from view. Now, this is by a Jewish general who recorded the events very accurately of the Jewish battle for Rome. For the conquest of Jerusalem by Rome. What do you think about that?
Well, he doesn't have any religious bias. I mean, it seems as if he's just reporting
He's reporting the facts.
They're seeing this. Maybe other people might be seeing this, you know, as signs that, you know, their religion sort of incorporates. But he's looking at it as just something that's happening in front of his eyes.
He's a highly credible witness. Let's take a look at some other things, too. Things that were written afterwards. There are a lot of different books that have been proposed to belong to the Bible. One which was not kept, however, was one called Proto-Evangelium of James. And I've read it repeatedly, and it's a very biblical-sounding book, to tell the truth, but I can understand why it might not have been accepted as a, you know, inspired work. But historically, I think there's some truth to it. Let's take a look at it. Proto-Evangelium basically means the first gospel, and it's a story written up in part about the nativity of Christ. It's a story of Mary and Joseph and the story of Christ. And here is this story from the Proto-Evangelium of James. So I'll just take a direct quote from chapter 19. And so here's the way it reads. "And I saw a woman coming down from the mountain, and she said to me, 'Man, where are you going?' And I said, 'I am seeking a Hebrew midwife.' Replying, she said to me, 'Are you from Israel?' And I said to her, 'Yes.' Then she said, 'And who is giving birth in the cave?' And I said, 'The one who has been pledged to be married to me.'" So this is Joseph speaking, as you can see. "And she said to me, 'She's not your wife.' And I said to her, 'She's Mary, the one who was raised in the temple. I won her by lot to be my wife. She is not yet my wife, but has a fetus from the Holy Spirit.' And the midwife said, 'Really?' And Jesus said, 'Come and see.' So the midwife went with him, and they stood near the cave, and a dark cloud was hovering over the cave. And the midwife said, "My soul glorifies this day, for today my eyes have seen a miracle. Salvation has come to Israel." And suddenly the cloud withdrew from the cave, and a great light appeared in the cave so that their eyes could not bear it. And a little while later, the same light withdrew until an infant appeared, and he came and took the breast of his mother Mary. Now, that book was written probably around 50 to 100 AD.
Wow.
What do you think about that? I mean, I don't know.
A lot of this stuff is amazing. So, you know, what are, you know, some of your conclusions from this?
Yeah. Well, you know, there's really got to be something going on there. There really is. I think, you know, and we can even take a look at another one. I don't know if we have enough time to do the...
Yeah, I think we can sneak one in here. We'll get it
but
in.
But let me just... I'll paraphrase it here very briefly, but some of you might know of it. Blessed Anne Catherine Emmerich. She was a visionary, stigmatist, 1774 to 1824, who died at 49 years of age. But in 2004, was beatified by Pope John Paul II. And she had a biographer by the name of Clemens Brentano. And he, in fact, recorded her visions. And in one of her visions, she talks about the birth of Christ. He talks about the birth of Christ as well. And again, there's a statement in there all about the birth of Christ and how it's accompanied by this divine light. I don't know. Can you accept it? Can you believe it? Is it real? I don't know. But, you know, this sort of stuff is kind of what I look at makes me kind of wonder.
Well, I look at, you know, what was, you know, Shakespeare, for example, and there, you know, when he talks to Horatio, one of the characters, Hamlet, and he said, "There are more things in heaven and earth, Horatio, than your philosophy have dreamt of." Horatio was sort of a very, what you might call a realist or, a factualist or a materialist. And he's berated here because there are. I mean, there has to be something under the givens that we have to deal with every day. And so these explanations are not fantastic. People have observed them. They see what their eyes are showing them. And if they're not the kind of scientific manifestation that we can, you know, explain scientifically, it doesn't mean that they don't exist.
Mm-hmm. That's true. I mean, you can find other writers, too, like Ignatius, the Bishop of Antioch, wrote about, you know, Jesus being born in an unspeakable light. You know, it's amazing. The Mystical City of God by St. Mary of Jesus also talks about it. So there's a lot of evidence out there which seems to support the idea that it's not just simply some sort of a physical phenomenon in the sky we're looking at.
And there need not be a war between science and these explanations. I mean, you do not have to have the kind of scientific explanation by, you know, the scientific rules and so forth that some people demand.
No. I'm not saying that this is the answer. I'm saying that this is a suggestion. This is something that you should consider. It makes a lot of sense. I mean, indeed, it could be what we call a midrash. It could be a fable, though I don't think that would occur because then it lends incredulity, if you will, to the Bible story. I think, you know, these stories were written at a time when people are still familiar with the history and life of Christ. And these books would have been rejected by the early church had they, in fact, contained falsehoods of that nature.
So, just too much evidence that things did happen and they were observed and they've been handed down for 2,000 years. And there's a human nature ourselves. There is something in us that responds to something more than just the outward physical manifestations that we see.
Yeah.
And these things shouldn't be set aside simply in favor of one particular explanation.
Yeah, I don't think we'll ever know.
Or non-explanation sometimes.
We'll never know. I don't think we ever will.
No.
But I think interpreting the Star of Bethlehem as the glory of the Lord adds a real great depth, a true meaning, a inspired inspiration to the Christmas story. I mean, come on. What human father would not want to be the present at the birth of a child, his child? Could we expect anything less from God the Father?
No, I don't think that we could.
Neither do I.
And I think that these manifestations are, you know, something given to us, and that they're the outward, if not explanations, outward signs, and that's what we know they are, signs of beautiful, beautiful, deep, faithful things that are going on. you know, within in us and within the universe itself.
Mm-hmm. So. Yeah, it's just that, you know, sometimes you might want to be incredulous, but it's only when you start accepting that you finally understand. And I kind of feel that's the way I've been. It's like, you know, faith is a perfection of reason. I mean, reason tells me that there's something here that's not physical. And, you know, though I might make a faith and say, yeah, because Midrash, maybe it was more likely, in my opinion, you know, this glory of the Lord, that's a real leap of faith. But that's what you find solace in,
exactly.
Consolation in,
and I think Thomas Aquinas, you know, puts his finger on when he says, I believe so that I may understand.
Yes.
Because we understand then our science, our daily life, and the whole world and universe more fully when we put the two together.
Yeah, I think it's so very true.
At any rate, we're going to have to stop here, and it's been a wonderful, wonderful story again, and it always is, and it brings a lot to us. I hope everyone out there enjoyed it, and we're going to see you again in a couple of weeks. We're going to be off here next week. I want to mention also, Carl, you were going to mention the Speakers Bureau that you were talking about.
Yep, we got the Speakers Bureau here and at the station for Catholic Spirit Radio, and I'm happy to come out and give talks and actually illustrate some of the things I've talked about here. We can only talk about comets and words, but we can talk about planetary conjunctions, but I can actually demonstrate that with my computer. So if anyone is interested in possibly having a talk for their social group, their church group or whatever, give the station a call. We can arrange it. We do ask for a small contribution to help support the efforts of the station. And then also another thing that I would like to offer is a Bible study, and we'll make that available to the station. So I suspect we should look for the Star of Bethlehem Bible study on the station's website in a few days, and perhaps it'll already be up now. And take a look for it and begin your investigation of the Star of Bethlehem.
And it sounds good. So we're going to wish everybody out there a very, very Merry Christmas and a very, very Happy New Year. And remember, we'll pray for you. Please pray for us and help Catholic Spirit Radio wherever and whenever you can. So again, we'll see you after the first of the year.
You've been listening to Being Catholic with Bob Johnston on Catholic Spirit Radio 89.5. If you'd like to contact Bob, email bob@catholicspiritradio.com. Again, that's bob@catholicspiritradio.com. Catholic Spirit Radio relies on your support to bring programming like this and EWTN to Central Illinois 24 hours a day. Please help keep Catholic Spirit Radio on the air with your generous support. Donate online at CatholicSpiritRadio.com or send a donation to Catholic Spirit Radio, 108 Boykins Place, Normal, Illinois, 61761. That's Catholic Spirit Radio, 108 Boykins Place, Normal, Illinois, 61761. Catholic Spirit Radio is a 501c3, and all donations are tax deductible. Thank you for your support of Catholic Spirit Radio 89.5.